Oh, yeah, she talked to me. It all poured out. She got on all right with the father, with Sralik. He sounded all right. The mother's a right mad bitch, though. Oh, yeah. Pills. Popping pills. Fucking rich bitches taking pills for their fucking nerves. Lula could talk to me, see? Well, it's a bond, innit? You can't break it. Blood. She was scared what that bitch would do if she found out Lula was looking for her real mum. She was proper worried about what the cow was going to do when the press found out about me. But there you are. When you're famous like she was, they find out everything, don't they? Oh, the lies they tell, though. Some of the things they said about me. I'm still thinking of suing. What was I saying? Her mother, yeah. I says to Lula, why worry, love? Sounds to me like you're better off without her anyway. Let her be pissed off if she don't want us to see each other. But she was a good girl, Lula, and she kept visiting her out of duty. Anyway, she had her own life. She was free to do what she wanted, weren't she? She had Evan, a man of her own. I told her I disapproved, mind, said Marlene Higson, with a pantomime of strictness. Oh, yeah, drugs. I've seen too many go that way. But I have to admit, he's a sweet boy underneath. I have to admit that. He didn't have nothing to do with it, I can tell you that.
Met him, did you?
No, but she called him once while she was with me and I heard him on the phone together, and they were a lovely couple. Nah, I got nothing bad to say about Evan. He had nothing to do with it, that's proved. Nah, I've got nothing bad to say about him. As long as he'd have gone clean, he'd have had my blessing. I said to her, bring him along, see whether I approve, but she never... He was always busy. He's a lovely-looking boy, under all that air, said Marlene. You can see it in all his photos.
Did she talk to you about her neighbours?
Oh, that Fred B. Stweegee. Yeah, she told me all about him offering her parts in his films. I said to her, why not? It might be a laugh. Even if she hadn't liked it, it would have been, what, another $500,000 in the bank?
Her bloodshot eyes squinted at nothing. She seemed momentarily mesmerised, lost in contemplation of some so vast and dazzling that they were beyond her ken, like an image of infinity. Merely to speak of them was to taste the power of money, to roll dreams of wealth around her mouth.
Did you ever hear her talk about Guy Sommet?
Oh, yes, she liked Guy. He was good to her. Personally, I prefer more classic things. It's not my kind of style.
The shocking pink lycra, tight on the rolls of fat spilling over the waistband of her leggings, rippled as she leaned forward to tap her cigarette delicately into the ashtray.
He's like a brother to me, she says. And I says, never mind pretend brothers, why don't we try and find my boys together?
But she weren't interested.
Your boys?
Me sons, me other kids. Yeah, I had two more after her. One with Des, and then later there was another one. Social services took them off me, but I says to her, with your money we could find them. Give me a bit, not much, I dunno, couple of grand, and I'll try and get someone to find them. Keep it quiet from the press. I'll handle it. I'll keep you out of it.
But she weren't interested, repeated Marlene.
Do you know where your sons are?
They took them as babies. I don't know where they are now. I was having problems. I ain't going to lie to you. I've had a bloody hard life.
And she told him, at length, about her hard life. It was a sordid story littered with violent men, with addiction and ignorance, neglect and poverty, and an animal instinct for survival that jettisoned babies in its wake, for they demanded skills that Marlene had never developed.
"So you don't know where your two sons are now?" Stripe repeated, 20 minutes later.
"No, how the fuck could I?"
said Marlene, who had talked herself into bitterness.
"She weren't interested anyway. She already had a white brother, didn't she? She was after black family. That's what she really wanted."
"Did she ask you about her father?"
"Yeah, and I told her everything I knew. He was an African student. Lived upstairs from me, just along the road here, Barking Road, with two others.
There's the bookies downstairs now. Very good-looking boy. Helped me with shopping a couple of times.
To hear Marlene Higson tell it, the courtship had proceeded with an almost Victorian respectability. She and the African student seemed barely to have progressed past handshakes during the first months of their acquaintance.
And then, 'cause he'd helped me all them times, one day I asked him in, you know, just as a thank you, really. I'm not a prejudiced person. Everyone's the same to me. Fancy a cuppa, I says, that were all. And then,
said Marlene, harsh reality clanging down amidst the vague impressions of teacups and doilies,
I finds out I'm expecting.
Did you tell him?
Oh, yeah. And he was full of how he was going to help and shoulder his responsibilities and make sure I was all right. And then it was the college holidays. He said he was coming back,
said Marlene contemptuously.
Then he ran a mile, don't they all? And what was I going to do? Run off to Africa to find him? It was no skin off my nose anyway. I wasn't breaking me heart. I was seeing Des by then. He didn't mind the baby. I moved in with Des not long after Joe left.
Joe?
That was his name. Joe.
She said it with conviction, but perhaps, thought Strike, that was because she had repeated the lie so often that the story had become easy, automatic.
What was his surname? I can't fucking remember. You're like her. It was 20-odd years ago. Mamumba, said Marlene Higson, unabashed. Or something like that.
Could it have been Aguman?
No.
Awuzu?
I told ya, she said aggressively. It were Mamumba or something.
Not MacDonald or Wilson?
You taking a piss? MacDonald, Wilson, from Africa?
Strike concluded that her relationship with the African had never progressed to the exchange of surnames.
And he was a student, you said. Where was he studying?
College, said Marlene.
Which one, can you remember? I don't bloody know. All right if I catch a ciggy, she added, in a slightly more conciliatory tone.
Yeah, help yourself. She lit her cigarette with her own plastic lighter, puffed enthusiastically, then said, mellowed by the free tobacco,
"It might have been something to do with a museum. Attached, like."
"Attached to a museum?"
"Yeah, 'cause I remember him saying, I sometimes visit the museum in my free hours."
Her imitation made the African student sound like an upper-class Englishman. She was smirking, as though this choice of recreation was absurd, ludicrous.
"Can you remember which museum it was that he visited?"
The Museum of England or something," she said. And then, irritably,
"You're like her. How the fuck am I supposed to remember after all this time?"
"And you never saw him again after he went home?"
"Nope," she said. "I wasn't expecting to."
She drank lager.
"He's probably dead," she said.
"Why do you say that?"
"Africa, innit?" she said. "He could have been shot, couldn't he? Or starved? Anything. You know what it's like out there."
Strike did know. He remembered the teeming streets of Nairobi, the aerial view of Angola's rainforest, mist hanging over the treetops, and the sudden breathtaking beauty, as the chopper turned, of a waterfall in the lush green mountainside. And the Maasai woman, baby at her breast, sitting on a box while Strike questioned her painstakingly about alleged rape, and Tracy manned the video camera beside him.
"Do you know whether Lula tried to find her father?"
"Yeah, she tried," said Marlene dismissively.
"How?"
"She looked up college records," said Marlene.
"But if you couldn't remember where he went..."
"I don't know, she thought she found a place or something, but she couldn't find him, no. Maybe I wasn't remembering his name right, I don't know. She used to go on and fucking on. What did he look like? Where was he studying? I said to her he was tall and skinny, and you want to be grateful you got my ears, not his. Because there wouldn't have been no fucking modelling career if you got them fucking elephant lugs."
"Did Lula ever talk to you about her friends?"
"Oh, yeah. There was that little black bitch, Raquel, or whatever she called herself, leeching all she could out of Lula.
Oh, she did herself all right. Fucking clothes and jewellery and I don't know what the fuck else. I says to Lula once, I wouldn't mind a new coat. But I wasn't pushy, see. That Raquel didn't mind asking.
She sniffed and drained her glass.
Did you ever meet Rochelle? That was her name, was it? Yeah, once. She come along in a fucking car with a driver to pick Lula up from seeing me. Like Lady Muck out the back window, sneering at me. She'd be missing all of that now, I expect. In it for all she could get. And there was that Kiara Porter,
Marlene ploughed on, with, if possible, even greater spite, sleeping with Lula's boyfriend the night she fucking died, nasty fucking bitch.
Do you know Kiara Porter?
I seen it in the fucking papers. He went off to her place, didn't he, Evan? After he rowed with Lula, went to Kiara, fucking bitch.
It became clear, as Marlene talked on, that Lula had kept her natural mother firmly segregated from her friends, and that, with the exception of a brief glimpse of Rochelle, Marlene's opinions and deductions about Lula's social set were based entirely on the press reports she had greedily consumed. Strike fetched more drinks, and listened to Marlene describe the horror and shock she had experienced on hearing, from the neighbour who had run in with the news early in the morning of the 8th, that her daughter had fallen to her death from her balcony. Careful questioning revealed that Lula had not seen Marlene for 2 months before she died. Strike then listened to a diatribe about the treatment she had received from Lula's adoptive family following the model's death.
They didn't want me around, especially that fucking uncle. Have you met him, have you? Fucking Tony Landry? I contacted him about the funeral and all I got was threats. Oh, yeah, fucking threats. I said to him, I'm her mother. I've got a right to be there. And he told me I wasn't her mother. That mad bitch was her mother, Lady Bristow. Funny, I says, because I remember pushing her out of my fanny. Sorry for my crudity, but there you are. And he said I was causing distress, talking to the press. They come and found me, she told Strike furiously, and she jabbed her finger at the block of flats overlooking them. Press, come and found me. Course I told my side of the fucking story. Course I did. Well, I didn't want a scene, not at a funeral. I didn't want to ruin things, but I wasn't going to be kept away. I went and sat at the back. I seen fucking Rochelle there giving me looks like I was dirt. But nobody stopped me in the end. They got what they wanted, that fucking family. I didn't get nothing. Nothing. That's not what Lula would have wanted. I know that for a fact.
She would have wanted me to have something.
Not, said Marlene, with an assumption of dignity, that I cared about the money. It weren't about the money for me. Nothing was going to replace my daughter. Not 10, not 20 mil. Mind you, she'd have been livid if she'd known I didn't get nothing, she went on. All that money going begging. People can't believe it when I tell them I got nothing. Struggling to make the rent, and me own daughter left millions. But there you are. That's how the rich stay rich, ain't it? They didn't need it, but they didn't mind a bit more. I don't know how that Landry sleeps at night, but that's his business.
Did Lula ever tell you she was going to leave you anything? Did she mention having made a will? Marlene seemed suddenly alert to a whiff of hope.
Oh, yeah. She said she'd look after me, yeah, yeah. She told me she'd see me all right. Do you think I should have told someone that? Mentioned it, like?
I don't think it would have made any difference, unless she made a will and left you something in it, said Strike. Her face fell back into its sullen expression.
They probably fucking destroyed it, them bastards. They could have done. That's the sort of people they are. I wouldn't put nothing past that uncle.
Chapter 5
I'm so sorry he hasn't got back to you, Robin told the caller, 7 miles away in the office. Mr. Strike's incredibly busy at the moment. Let me take your name and number, and I'll make sure he phones you this afternoon.
Oh, there's no need for that, said the woman. She had a pleasant, cultivated voice, with a faint suspicion of hoarseness, as though her laugh would be sexy and bold. I don't really need to speak to him. Could you just give him a message for me? I wanted to warn him, that's all. God, this is... it's a bit embarrassing. It isn't the way I'd have chosen. Well, anyway. Could you please just tell him that Charlotte Campbell called and that I'm engaged to Jago Ross? I didn't want him to hear about it from anyone else or read about it. Jago's parents have gone and put it in the bloody Times. Mortifying.
Oh, all right,
said Robin, her mind suddenly paralysed like a pen.
Thanks very much. Robin, did you say? Thanks. Bye.
Charlotte rang off first. Robin replaced the receiver in slow motion, feeling acutely anxious. She did not want to deliver this news. She might be only the messenger, but she would feel as though she were delivering an assault on Strike's determination to keep his private life under wraps, on his firm avoidance of the subject of the boxes of possessions, the camp bed, the detritus of his evening meals and the bins every morning. Robin pondered her options. She could forget to relay the message, and simply tell him to call Charlotte and get her to do her own dirty work, as Robin put it to herself. What though if Strike refused to call, and somebody else told him about the engagement? Robin had no means of knowing whether Strike and his ex, girlfriend, fiancé, wife, had legions of mutual friends. If she and Matthew ever split up, if he became engaged to another woman, it gave her a twisting feeling in her chest to even think of it. All her closest friends and family would feel involved, and would undoubtedly stampede to tell her. She would, she supposed, prefer to be forewarned in as low-key and private a way as possible. When she heard Strike ascending the stair nearly an hour later, apparently talking on his mobile and in good spirits, Robin experienced a sharp stab of panic to the stomach, as though she were about to sit an exam. When he pushed open the glass door, and she saw that he was not holding a mobile at all, but rapping under his breath, she felt even worse.
"Fuck your meds and fuck Joe Harry," muttered Strike, who was holding a boxed electric fan in his arms.
"Afternoon."
"Hello."
"Thought we could use this. It's stuffy in here."
"Yes, that would be good."
"Just a DB Mac playing in the shop," Strike informed her, setting down the fan in a corner and peeling off his jacket. "Something, something, and Ferrari. Fuck your meds and fuck Joe Harry."
"Wonder who Joe Harry was."
"Some rapper he was having a feud with, do you think?"
"No," said Robin, wishing that he was not so cheerful. "It's a psychological term. The Johari window. It's all to do with how well we know ourselves and how well other people know us."
Strike paused in the act of hanging up his jacket and stared at her.
"You didn't get that out of Heat magazine?"
"No, I was doing psychology at university. I dropped out."
She felt obscurely that it might somehow even the playing field to tell him about one of her own personal failures before delivering the bad news.
"You dropped out of university?"
He seemed uncharacteristically interested.
"That's a coincidence. I did too. So why fuck Johari?"
"DB Mack had therapy in prison. He became interested and did a lot of reading on psychology. I got that bit out of the papers," she added.
"You're a mine of useful information."
She experienced another elevated drop in the pit of her stomach.
"There was a call when you were out from a Charlotte Campbell."
He looked up quickly, frowning.
"She asked me to give you a message which was..." Robin's gaze slid sideways to hover momentarily on Strike's ear. "That she's engaged to Jago Ross."
Her eyes were drawn irresistibly back to his face, and she felt a horrible chill. One of the earliest and most vivid memories of Robin's childhood was of the day that the family dog had been put down. She herself had been too young to understand what her father was saying. She took the continuing existence of Bruno, her oldest brother's beloved Labrador, for granted. Confused by her parents' solemnity, she had turned to Stephen for a clue as to how to react, and all security had crumbled, for she had seen, for the first time in her short life, happiness and comfort drain out of his small and merry face, and his lips whiten as his mouth fell open. She had heard oblivion howling in the silence that preceded his awful scream of anguish,
and then she had cried, inconsolably, not for Bruno, but for the terrifying grief of her brother. Strike did not speak immediately. Then he said, with palpable difficulty,
"Right.
Thanks." He walked into the inner office and closed the door. Robin sat back down at her desk, feeling like an executioner. She could not settle to anything. She considered knocking on the door again and offering a cup of tea, but decided against. For 5 minutes, she restlessly reorganized the items on her desk, glancing regularly at the closed inner door, until it opened again and she jumped and pretended to be busy at the keyboard.
"Robin, I am just going to nip out," he said.
"Okay.
If I'm not back at 5, you can lock up."
"Yes, of course."
"See you tomorrow."
He took down his jacket and left with a purposeful tread that did not deceive her. The roadworks were spreading like a lesion. Every day there was an extension of the mayhem and of the temporary structures to protect pedestrians and enable them to pick their way through the devastation. Strike noticed none of it. He walked automatically over trembling wooden boards to the Tottenham, the place he associated with escape and refuge. Like the Ordnance Arms, it was empty but for one other drinker, an old man just inside the door. Strike bought a pint of Doom Bar and sat down on one of the low red leather seats against the wall, almost beneath the sentimental Victorian maid who scattered rosebuds, sweet and silly and simple. He drank as though his beer was medicine, without pleasure, intent on the result. Jago Ross. She must have been in touch with him, seeing him, while they were still living together. Even Charlotte, with all her mesmeric power over men, her astonishing sure-handed skill, could not have moved from reacquaintance to engagement in 3 weeks. She had been meeting Ross on the sly, while swearing undying love to Strike. This put a very different light on the bombshell she had dropped on him a month before the end, and the refusal to show him proof, and the shifting dates, and the sudden conclusion of it all. Jago Ross had been married once already. He had kids. Charlotte had heard on the grapevine that he was drinking hard. She had laughed with Strike about her lucky escape of so many years before. She had expressed pity for his wife. Strike bought a second pint, and then a third. He wanted to drown the impulses, crackling like electrical charges, to go and find her, to bellow, to rampage, to break Jago Ross's jaw. He had not eaten at the Ordnance Arms, and it had been a long time since he had consumed so much alcohol in one sitting. It took him barely an hour of steady, solitary, determined beer consumption to become properly drunk. Initially, when the slim, pale figure appeared at his table, he told it thickly that it had the wrong man and the wrong table. "No, I haven't," said Robin firmly. "I'm just going to get myself a drink too, all right." She left him staring hazily at her handbag, which she had placed on the stool. It was comfortingly familiar, brown, a little shabby. She usually hung it up on a coat peg in the office. He gave it a friendly smile and drank to it. Up at the bar, the barman, who was young and timid-looking, said to Robin, "I think he's had enough." "That's hardly my fault," she retorted. She had looked for Strike in the Intrepid Fox, which was nearest to the office, in Molly Mogg's The Spice of Life and the Cambridge. The Tottenham had been the last pub she was planning to try.
"What's the matter?"
Strike asked her when she sat down.
"Nothing's the matter," said Robin, sipping her half-lager. "I just wanted to make sure you're okay."
"Yes, I'm fine," said Strike.
And then, with an effort at clarity,
"I am fine."
"Good."
"Just celebrating my fiancée's engagement," he said,
raising his 11th pint in an unsteady toast.
"She should never have left him. Never," he said, loudly and clearly. "Have left. The Honourable Jago Ross, who is an outstanding cunt.
He virtually shouted the last word. There were more people in the pub than when Strike had arrived, and most of them seemed to have heard him. They had been casting him wary looks even before he shouted. The scale of him, with his drooping eyelids and his bellicose expression, had ensured a small no-go zone around him. People skirted his table on the way to the bathrooms, as though it was three times the size.
"Shall we take a walk?" Robin suggested. "Get something to eat."
"Do you know what?" he said, leaning forwards with his elbows on the table, almost knocking over his pint. "Do you know what, Robin?"
"What?" she said, holding his beer steady. She was suddenly possessed of a strong desire to giggle. Many of their fellow drinkers were watching them.
"You're a very nice girl," said Strike. "You are. You're a very nice person. I've noticed," he said, nodding solemnly. "Yes, I've noticed that."
"Thank you," she said, smiling, trying not to laugh. He sat back in his seat, closed his eyes and said,
"Sorry. I'm pissed."
"Yes."
"Don't do it much these days."
"No."
"I haven't eaten anything."
"Should we go and get something to eat, then?"
"Yeah, we could do," he said, with his eyes still shut. "She told me she was pregnant."
"Oh," said Robin sadly.
"Yeah, told me. And then she said it was gone. Can't have been mine. Never had it up."
Robin said nothing. She did not want him to remember that she had heard this. He opened his eyes.
"She left him for me, and now she left him... No, she left me for him."
"I'm sorry."
"Left me for him. Don't be sorry. You're a nice person."
He pulled cigarettes out of his pocket and inserted one between his lips.
"You can't smoke in here,"
she reminded him gently. But the barman, who seemed to have been waiting for a cue, came hurrying over towards them now, looking tense.
"You need to go outside to do that,"
he told Strike loudly.
Strike peered up at the boy, bleary-eyed, surprised.
"It's all right," Robin told the barman, gathering up her handbag.
"Come on, Cormoran."
He stood, massive, ungainly, swaying, unfolding himself out of the cramped space behind the table and glaring at the barman, whom Robin could not blame for taking a step backwards.
"There's no need," Strike told him, "to shout. No need. Fucking rude."
"Okay, Cormoran, let's go," said Robin, standing back to give him space to pass.
"Just a moment, Robin," said Strike,
one large hand held aloft.
"Just a moment."
"Oh, God," said Robin quietly.
"Have you ever done any boxing?"
Strike asked the barman, who looked terrified.
"Cormoran, let's go."
"I was a boxer. In the army, mate."
Over at the bar, some wisecracker murmured, "I could have been a contender."
"Let's go, Cormoran," said Robin.
She took his arm, and to her great relief and surprise, he came along meekly. It reminded her of leading the enormous Clydesdale her uncle had kept on his farm. Out in the fresh air, Strike leaned back against one of the Tottenham's windows and tried, fruitlessly, to light his cigarette. Robin had to work the lighter for him in the end.
"What you need is food," she told him,
as he smoked with his eyes closed, listing slightly so that she was afraid he would fall over.
"Sober you up."
"I don't want to sober up," Strike muttered.
He overbalanced and only saved himself from falling with several rapid sidesteps.
"Come on,"
she said, and she guided him across the wooden bridge spanning the gulf in the road, where the clattering machines and builders had at last fallen silent and departed for the night.
"Robin, did you know I was a boxer?"
"No, I didn't know that," she said.
She had meant to take him back to the office and give him food there, but he came to a halt at the kebab shop at the end of Denmark Street and had lurched through the door before she could stop him.
Sitting outside on the pavement at the only table, they ate kebabs, and he told her about his boxing career in the army, digressing occasionally to remind her what a nice person she was. She managed to persuade him to keep his voice down. The full effect of all the alcohol he had consumed was still making itself felt, and food seemed to be doing little to help. When he went off to the bathroom, he took such a long time that she began to worry that he had passed out. Checking her watch, she saw that it was now 7:10. She called Matthew and told him she was dealing with an urgent situation at the office. He did not sound pleased. Strike wound his way back onto the street, bouncing off the doorframe as he emerged. He planted himself firmly against the window and tried to light another cigarette.
"Robin,"
he said, giving up and gazing down at her.
"Robin, do you know what a Kairos mo—"
he hiccuped.
"Moment is?"
"A Kairos moment," she repeated, hoping against hope it was not something sexual, something that she would not be able to forget afterwards, especially as the kebab shop owner was listening in and smirking behind them. "No, I don't. Shall we go back to the office?"
"You don't know what it is?"
he asked, peering at her.
"No. It's Greek,"
he told her.
"Kairos. Kairos moment. And it means..."
And from somewhere in his soused brain, he dredged up words of surprising clarity.
"The telling moment. The special moment. The supreme moment."
"Oh, please," thought Robin. "Please don't tell me we're having one."
"And do you know what ours was, Robin? Mine and Charlotte's?"
he said, staring into the middle distance, his unlit cigarette hanging from his hand.
"It was when she walked into the ward. I was in the hospital for a long time, and I hadn't seen her for 2 years, no warning. And I saw her in the door, and everyone turned and saw her too. And she walked down the ward, and she never said a word, and..."
He paused to draw breath, and hiccuped again.
"And she kissed me after 2 years, and we were back together. Nobody talking. Fucking beautiful. Most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Best moment of the whole fucking... my whole fucking life, probably. I'm sorry, Robin," he added, "for saying fucking. I'm sorry about that."
Robin felt equally inclined to laughter and tears, though she did not know why she should feel so sad.
"Shall I light that cigarette for you?" "You're a great person, Robin. You know that."
Near the turning into Denmark Street, he stopped dead, still swaying like a tree in the wind, and told her loudly that Charlotte did not love Jago Ross. It was all a game to hurt him, strike, as badly as she could. Outside the black door to the office, he halted again, holding up both hands to stop her following him upstairs.
"You gotta go home now, Robin."
"Let me just make sure you get upstairs, okay?"
"No, no. I'm fine now. And I might chunder. I'm legless. And..."
said Strike.
"You don't get that fucking tired old fucking joke, huh? Or do you? Know most of it now. Did I tell you?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"Never mind, Robin. You go home now. I gotta be sick."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sorry I kept saying fuck, swearing. You're a nice person, Robin. Goodbye now."
She looked back at him when she reached Charing Cross Road. He was walking with the awful, clumsy deliberation of the very drunk towards the dingy entrance to Denmark Place, there, no doubt, to vomit in the dark alleyway, before staggering upstairs to his camp bed and kettle. Chapter 6. There was no clear moment of moving from sleep to consciousness. At first he was lying face down in a dreamscape of broken metal, rubble and screams, blooded and unable to speak, Then he was lying on his stomach, doused in sweat, his face pressed into the camp bed, his head a throbbing ball of pain, and his open mouth dry and rank. The sun pouring in at the unblinded windows scoured his retinas even with his eyelids closed. Raw red, with capillaries spread like fine black nets over tiny, taunting, popping lights. He was fully clothed, his prosthesis still attached, lying on top of his sleeping bag as though he had fallen there. Stabbing memories, like glass shards through his temple, persuading the barman that another pint was a good idea. Robin, across the table, smiling at him. Could he really have eaten a kebab in the state he was in? At some point he remembered wrestling his fly, desperate to piss, but unable to extract the end of shirt caught in his zip. He slid a hand underneath himself, even this slight movement made him want to groan or vomit, and found, to his vague relief, that the zip was closed. Slowly, like a man balancing some fragile package on his shoulders, Strike moved himself into a sitting position and squinted around the brightly lit room with no idea what time it could be, or indeed, what day it was. The door between inner and outer offices was closed, and he could not hear any movement on the other side. Perhaps his temp had left for good. Then he saw a white oblong lying on the floor, just inside the door, pushed under the gap at the bottom. Strike moved gingerly onto his hands and knees, and retrieved what he soon saw was a note from Robin. Dear Cormoran, he supposed there was no going back to Mr. Strike now. I read your list of points to investigate further at the front of the file. I thought I might be able to follow up the first two, Agumon and the Malmaison Hotel. I will be on my mobile if you would rather I came back to the office. I have set an alarm just outside your door for 2 p.m, so that you have enough time to get ready for your 5 p.m. appointment at 1 Arlington Place to interview Kiara Porter and Bryony Radford. There is water, paracetamol, and Alka-Seltzer on the desk outside. Robin. P.S. Please don't be embarrassed about last night. You didn't say or do anything you should regret. He sat quite still on his camp bed for 5 minutes, holding the note, wondering whether he was about to throw up, but enjoying the warm sunshine on his back. 4 paracetamol and a glass of Alka-Seltzer, which almost decided the vomiting question for him, were followed by 15 minutes in a dingy toilet, with results offensive to both nose and ear. But he was sustained throughout by a feeling of profound gratitude for Robin's absence. Back in the outer office, he drank 2 more bottles of water and turned off the alarm, which had set his throbbing brains rattling in his skull. After some deliberation, he chose a set of clean clothes, took shower gel, deodorant, razor, shaving cream and towel out of the kit bag, pulled a pair of swimming trunks out of the bottom of one of the cardboard boxes on the landing, extracted the pair of grey metal crutches from another, then limped down the metal stair with a sports bag over his shoulder and the crutches in his other hand. He bought himself a family-sized bar of dairy milk on the way to Mallet Street. Bernie Coleman, an acquaintance in the Army Medical Corps, had once explained to Strike how the majority of the symptoms associated with a crashing hangover were due to dehydration and hypoglycemia, which were the inevitable results of prolonged vomiting. Strike munched his way through the chocolate, crutches jammed under his arm, and every step jarring his head, which still felt as though it was being compressed by tight wires. But the laughing god of drunkenness had not yet forsaken him. Agreeably detached from reality and from his fellow human beings, he walked down the steps to the Yulu pool with an unfeigned sense of entitlement, and as usual, nobody challenged him, not even the only other occupant of the changing room, who, after one glance of arrested interest at the prosthesis Strike was unstrapping, kept his eyes politely averted. His false leg stuffed into a locker along with yesterday's clothes, and leaving the door open due to a lack of change, Strike moved towards the shower on crutches, his belly spilling over the top of his trunks. He noted, as he soaped himself, that the chocolate and paracetamol were beginning to take the edge off his nausea and pain. Now, for the first time, he walked out to the large pool. There were only two students in here, both in the fast lane and wearing goggles, oblivious to everything but their own prowess. Strike proceeded to the far side, set the crutches down carefully beside the steps, and slid into the slow lane. He was more unfit than he had ever been in his life. Ungainly and lopsided, he kept swimming into the side of the pool, but the cool, clean water was soothing to body and spirit. Panting, he completed a single length and rested there, his thick arms spread along the side of the pool, sharing the responsibility for his heavy body with the caressing water and gazing up at the high white ceiling. Little waves, outrunners sent by the young athletes on the other side of the pool, tickled his chest. The terrible pain in his head was receding into the distance. A fiery red light viewed through mist. The chlorine was sharp and clinical in his nostrils, but it no longer made him want to be sick. Deliberately, like a man ripping off a bandage on a congealing wound, Strike turned his attention to the thing he had attempted to drown in alcohol. Jago Ross. In every respect, the antithesis of Strike. Handsome in the manner of an Aryan prince, possessor of a trust fund, born to fulfill a preordained place in his family and the world, a man with all the confidence 12 generations of well-documented lineage can give. He had quit a succession of high-flying jobs, developed a persistent drinking problem, and was vicious in the manner of an overbred, badly disciplined animal. Charlotte and Ross belonged to that tight, interconnected network of public-schooled blue-bloods who all knew each other's families, connected through generations of interbreeding and old-school ties. While the water lapped his thickly hairy chest, Strike seemed to see himself, Charlotte and Ross at a great distance, from the wrong end of a telescope, so that the arc of their story became clear. It mirrored Charlotte's restless day-to-day behaviour, that craving for heightened emotion that expressed itself most typically in destructiveness. She had secured Jago Ross as a prize when 18, the most extreme example she could find of his type and the very epitome of eligibility, as her parents had seen it. Perhaps that had been too easy, and certainly too expected, because she had then dumped him for Strike, who, for all his brains, was anathema to Charlotte's family, an uncategorizable mongrel. What was left, after all these years, to a woman who craved emotional storms, but to leave Strike again and again, until at last the only way to leave with real éclat was to move full circle back to the place where he had found her. Strike allowed his aching body to float in the water. The racing students were still thrashing their way up and down the fast lane. Strike knew Charlotte. She was waiting for him to rescue her. It was the final, cruelest test. He did not swim back down the pool, but hopped sideways through the water, using his arms to grip the long side of the pool, as he had done during physiotherapy in the hospital. The second shower was more pleasurable than the first. He made the water as hot as he could stand, lathered himself all over, then turned the dial to cold to rinse himself. The prosthesis reattached, he shaved over a sink with a towel tied around his waist, then dressed with unusual care. He had never worn the most expensive suit and shirt that he owned. They had been gifts from Charlotte on his last birthday, raiment suitable for her fiancé. He remembered her beaming at him as he stared at his unfamiliarly well-styled self in a full-length mirror. The suit and shirt had hung in their carry case ever since, because he and Charlotte had not gone out much after last November, because his birthday had been the last truly happy day they had spent together. Soon afterwards, the relationship had begun to stagger back into the old familiar grievances, into the same mire in which it had foundered before, but which, this time, they had sworn to avoid. He might have incinerated the suit. Instead, in a spirit of defiance, he chose to wear it, to strip it of its associations and render it mere pieces of cloth. The tailoring of the jacket made him look slimmer and fitter. He left the white shirt open at the throat.
Strike had had a reputation in the army for being able to bounce back from excessive alcohol consumption with unusual speed. The man staring at him out of the small mirror was pale, with purple shadows under his eyes, yet in the sharp Italian suit he looked better than he had done in weeks. His black eye had vanished at last, and his scratches had healed. A cautiously light meal, copious amounts of water, another evacuatory trip to the restaurant bathroom, more painkillers, then, at 5 o'clock, a prompt arrival at number 1 Arlington Place. The door was answered, after his second knock, by a cross-looking woman in black-framed glasses and a short grey bob. She let him in with an appearance of reluctance, then walked briskly away across a stone-floored hall, which incorporated a magnificent staircase with a wrought-iron banister, calling, "Gee! Somebody strike!" There were rooms on both sides of the hall. To the left, a small knot of people, all of whom seemed to be dressed in black, was staring in the direction of some powerful light source that Strike could not see, but which illuminated their rapt faces. Semei appeared, striding through this door into the hall. He too was wearing glasses, which made him look older. His jeans were baggy and ripped, and his white T-shirt was emblazoned with an eye that appeared to be weeping glittering blood, which on closer examination proved to be red sequins.
"You'll have to wait," he said curtly. "Brian is busy and Chiara's going to be hours. You can park yourself in there if you want."
He pointed towards the right-hand room, where the edge of a tray-laden table was visible.
"Or you can stand around and watch like these useless fuckers," he went on, suddenly raising his voice and glaring at the huddle of elegant young men and women who were staring towards the light source.
They dispersed at once without protest, some of them crossing the hall into the room opposite.
"Better suit, by the way," Semei added, with a flash of his old archness.
He marched back into the room from which he had come. Strike followed the designer and took up the space vacated by the roughly dispatched onlookers. The room was long and almost bare, but its ornate cornices, pale blank walls, and curtainless windows gave it an atmosphere of mournful grandeur. A further group of people, including a long-haired male photographer bent over his camera, stood between Strike and the scene at the far end of the room, which was dazzlingly illuminated by a series of arc lights and light screens. Here was an artful arrangement of tattered old chairs, one on its side, and three models. They were a breed apart, with faces and bodies in rare proportions that fell precisely between the categories of strange and impressive. Fine-boned and recklessly slim, they had been chosen, Strike assumed, for the dramatic contrast in their colouring and features. Sitting like Christine Keeler on a back-to-front chair, long legs splayed in spray-on-white leggings, but apparently naked from the waist up, was a black girl as dark-skinned as Semei himself, with an afro and slanting, seductive eyes. Standing over her, in a white vest decorated in chains, which just covered her pubis, was a Eurasian beauty with flat black hair cut into an asymmetric fringe. To one side, leaning alone and sideways on the back of another chair, was Chiara Porter. Alabaster fair, with long baby-blonde hair, wearing a white, semi-transparent jumpsuit through which her pale, pointed nipples were clearly visible. The makeup artist, almost as tall and thin as the models, was bending over the black girl, pressing a pad into the sides of her nose. The three models waited silently in position, still as portraits, all three faces blank and empty, waiting to be called to attention. The other people in the room, the photographer appeared to have two assistants, Semei, now biting his fingernails on the sidelines, was accompanied by the cross-looking woman in glasses, all spoke in low mutters, as though frightened of disturbing some delicate equilibrium. At last the makeup artist joined Semei, who talked inaudibly and rapidly to her, gesticulating. She stepped back into the bright light, and, without speaking to the model, ruffled and rearranged Chiara Porter's long mane of hair. Chiara showed no sign that she knew she was being touched, but waited in patient silence. Bryony retreated into the shadows once more,
and asked Sumay something. He responded with a shrug and gave her some inaudible instruction that had her look around until her eyes rested on Strike. They met at the foot of the magnificent staircase.
"Hi," she whispered. "Let's go through here."
She led him across the hall into the opposite room, which was slightly smaller than the first, and dominated by the large table covered with buffet-style food. Several long, wheeled clothing racks, jammed with sequined, ruffled, and feathered creations arranged, according to colour, stood in front of a marble fireplace. The displaced onlookers, all of them in their 20s, were gathered in here. Talking quietly, picking in desultory fashion at the half-empty platters of mozzarella and parma ham, and talking into, or playing with, their phones. Several of them subjected Strike to appraising looks as he followed Bryony into a small back room which had been turned into a makeshift makeup station. Two tables, with big portable mirrors, stood in front of the large single window, which looked out onto a spruce garden. The black plastic boxes standing around reminded Strike of those his Uncle Ted had taken fly fishing, except that Bryony's drawers were crammed with coloured powders and paints. Tubes and brushes lay lined up on towels, spread across the tabletops. "Hi," she said in a normal voice. "God, talk about cutting the tension with a knife, eh? Guy's always a perfectionist, but this is his first proper shoot since Lula died, so he's, you know, seriously uptight." She had dark, choppy hair. Her skin was sallow. Her features, though large, were attractive. She was wearing tight jeans on long, slightly bandy legs, a black vest, several fine gold chains around her neck, rings on her fingers and thumbs, and also what looked like black leather ballet shoes. This kind of footwear always had a slightly aphrodisiac effect on Strike, because it reminded him of the fold-up slippers his Aunt Joan used to carry in her handbag, and therefore of bunions and corns. Strike began to explain what he wanted from her, but she cut him off. "Guy's told me everything. Want a ciggy? We can smoke in here if we open this." So saying, she wrenched open the door that led directly onto a paved area of the garden. She made a small space on one of the cluttered makeup tables and perched herself on it. Strike took one of the vacated chairs and drew out his notebook. "Okay, fire away," she said. And then, without giving him time to speak, "I've been thinking about that afternoon non-stop ever since, actually. So, so sad."
"Did you know Lula well?" asked Strike.
"Yeah, pretty well. I'd done her makeup for a couple of shoots, made her up for the rainforest benefit. When I told her I can thread eyebrows..."
"You can what?"
"Thread eyebrows. It's like plucking, but with threads."
Strike could not imagine how this worked.
"Right."
"She asked me to do them for her at home. The paps were all over her, all the time, even if she was going to the salon. It was insane. So I helped her out." She had a habit of tossing back her head to flick her overlong fringe out of her eyes, and a slightly breathy manner. Now she threw her hair over to one side, raked it with her fingers, and peered at him through her fringe. "I got there about 3. She and Kiara were all excited about D.B. Mack arriving. Girly gossip, you know. I'd never have guessed what was coming. Never."
"Lula was excited, was she?"
"Oh, God, yeah. What do you think? How would you feel if someone had written songs about..." "Well," she said, with a breathy little laugh, "maybe it's a girl thing. He's so charismatic. Kiara and I were having a laugh about it while I did Lula's eyebrows. Then Kiara asked me to do her nails. I ended up making them both up as well, so I was there for must have been 3 hours. Yeah, I left about 6.
"So you'd describe Lula's mood as excited, would you?"
"Yeah. Well, you know, she was a bit distracted. She kept checking her phone. It was lying in her lap while I was doing her eyebrows. I knew what that meant. Evan was messing her around again."
"Did she say that?"
"No, but I knew she was really pissed off at him. Why do you think she said that to Kiara about her brother, about leaving him everything?"
This seemed a stretch to Strike. "Did you hear her say that, too?"
"What? No. But I heard about it. I mean afterwards. Kiara told us all. I think I was in the loo when she actually said it. Anyway, I totally believe it. Totally.
Why's that?
She looked confused.
Well, she really loved her brother, didn't she? God, that was always obvious. He was probably the only person she could really rely on. Months before, around the time she and Evan split up the first time, I was making her up for the Stella show, and she was telling everyone her brother was really pissing her off, going on and on about what a freeloader Evan was. And you know, Evan was jacking her around again, that last afternoon, so she was thinking that James, is it James, had had him right all along. She always knew he had her interest at heart, even if he was a bit bossy sometimes. This is a really, really exploitative business, you know. Everyone's got an agenda.
Who do you think had an agenda for Lula?
Oh my God, everyone,
said Bryony, making a wide, sweeping gesture with a cigarette-holding hand, which encompassed all of the inhabited rooms outside. She was the hottest model out there. Everyone wanted a piece of her. I mean, Guy.
But Bryony broke off.
Well, Guy's a businessman, but he did adore her. He wanted her to go and live with him after that stalker business. He's still not right about her dying. I heard he tried to contact her through some spiritualist. Margot Lita told me. He's still devastated. He can barely hear her name without crying. Anyway, said Bryony, that's all I know. I never dreamed that afternoon would be the last time I saw her. I mean, my God.
Did she talk about Duffield at all while you were, threading her eyebrows?
No, said Bryony. But she wouldn't, would she, if he was really hacking her off?
So, as far as you can remember, she mainly spoke about D.B. Mack.
Well, it was more Kiara and me talking about him.
But you think she was excited to meet him?
Oh, God, yes, of course.
Tell me, did you see a blue piece of paper with Lula's handwriting on it when you were in the flat?
Bryony shook her hair over her face again and combed it with her fingers.
What?
No. No, I didn't see anything like that. Why, what was it?
I don't know, said Strike. That's what I'd like to find out.
No, I didn't see it. Blue, did you say? No.
Did you see any paper at all with her writing on it?
No, I can't remember any papers. No. She shook her hair out of her face. I mean, something like that could have been lying around, but I wouldn't have necessarily noticed it. The room was dingy. Perhaps he only imagined that she had changed colour, but he had not invented the way she twisted her right foot up onto her knee and examined the sole of the leather ballet slipper for something that was not there.
Lula's driver, Kieran Colovers-Jones.
Oh, that really, really cute guy, said Bryony. We used to tease her about Kieran. He had such a gigantic crush on her. I think Kiara uses him now sometimes. Bryony gave a meaningful little giggle. She's got a bit of a rep as a good-time girl, Kiara. I mean, you can't help liking her, but...
Colovers-Jones says that Lula was writing something on blue paper in the back of his car when she left her mother's that day.
Have you talked to Lula's mother yet? She's a bit weird.
And I'd like to find out what it was.
Bryony flicked her cigarette stub out of the open door and shifted restlessly on the desk. It could have been anything. He waited for the inevitable suggestion and was not disappointed. A shopping list or something?
Yeah, it could have been. But if, for the sake of argument, it was a suicide note.
But it wasn't. I mean, that's silly. How could it have been? Who'd write a suicide note that far in advance, and then get their face done and go out dancing? That doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't seem likely, I agree. But it would be good to find out what it was.
Maybe it had nothing to do with her dying. Why couldn't it have been a letter to Evan or something, telling him how hacked off she was?
She doesn't seem to have become hacked off with him until later that day. Anyway, why would she write a letter when she had his telephone number and was going to see him that night?
Well, I don't know, said Bryony restlessly. I'm just saying it could have been something that doesn't make any difference.
And you're quite sure you didn't see it?
Yes, I'm quite sure, she said,
her colour definitely heightened. "I was there to do a job, not go snooping around her stuff." "Is that everything, then?"
"Yeah, I